This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Awakened Media, presenting The Real Dirt on Farmer John, a film about the true story of maverick farmer John Peterson's hero's journey of life, love, death, and sweet potatoes. Opens Wednesday, February 1st at Cinema 21. Information at therealdirt.net.
This is Between the Covers. I'm Jim Schumach, and welcome. My guest today is journalist and memoirist J.R. Moehringer. Born in New York City in 1964, he is the author of the memoir The Tender Bar, just published by Hyperion. Welcome to Between the Covers, J.R.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about your hometown, what it was like when you were growing up there, the high points and the low points.
Well, it's a town of bars, or it was when I was growing up there. It was a really unusual place, both upper class and blue collar. Some of the wealthiest families in America had their estates on Shelter Rock Road, one of the main thoroughfares.
We're talking about Manhasset.
Manhasset, Long Island, about 20 miles outside New York City. And the other main thoroughfare was just a street of one gin mill, tavern, saloon after another. Largely because you had these Irish and Italian immigrants who needed some place to go after they were done working on the estates as maids, gardeners, drivers, stable hands. My people descend from the service and tradespeople who worked on those estates. And Manhasset has been there for 400 years and for most of that time has flown under the radar. It's really only ever been known, and even then, not well known, as the place that F. Scott Fitzgerald set much of The Great Gatsby. It's the place he fictionalized as East Egg.
Tell us a bit about your father and your mother.
My father was a complicated mix of rage and charm. He was violent, but also brilliant. And when I was growing up, he was quite famous in New York. He was a DJ named Johnny Michaels, a rock and roll DJ at a time when rock and roll DJs were really bringing rock and roll to FM radio. They were making that transition from AM to FM. And they were not only celebrating rock and roll for people, but they were introducing people to the Beatles, explaining the Beatles to people, helping people understand this revolution that was taking place. They were MCs and comedians and personalities. They were bigger then. And my father was one of the biggest, briefly. And I grew up not knowing what he looked like, however, because he left home when I was 7 months old. He abandoned my mother and me. He left her without a penny, and he left me without a father figure. And the first half of my book is the story of the struggles of my mother and I to get by. And she's the hero of the book, but particularly that first half. She looms very large because she got us through some very tough times.
Your grandfather seems like perhaps he was a failed Jesuit or something. At least he was Jesuit trained, but that didn't really help him that much.
He's trained by the Jesuits. We lived in his house because we had no money, and we often didn't know where we were going to live, and we would sort of flop at my grandfather's house. And that's why he's a character in the early part of the book. And yeah, he like my father, kind of a curious mix of brilliant and wonderful qualities, but also curmudgeonly, miserly, withholding of love and other things. And the book is about the way I replaced my father with men from the corner bar. But before I ever replaced him, I auditioned different guys, boyfriends of my cousins, and I auditioned my grandfather as a possible surrogate father, and the audition was disastrous because he was such an enigmatic person. Maybe his Jesuit training had something to do with that, but I think that he's one of the real mysteries in the book, and in writing about him, I didn't get any closer to the heart of the mystery.
What about your grandmother?
She was a classic a victim. In a family of storytellers, in a town full of storytellers, She was the maestro, the greatest storyteller I've ever run across. And that's what I write about in the book, along with her subjugation to my grandfather. He was verbally abusive. He was emotionally and financially abusive. And she took it. She was dependent on him in a terrifying way. And I watched her be demeaned and degraded by him, and it was part of the sadness of growing up in that house, and it was a big part of what made my mother so sad every time we had to flop at Grandpa's, that she had to witness this dynamic between her parents.
I don't find any religion in your book. There's a priest in passing, but
yeah,
these are the kind of people we might have found under a priest, within a church somewhere.
Yeah, well, it's a very Catholic town. Again, it was. I mean, Manhasset has changed since I grew up. But at the time that the book opens, in the early 1970s, St. Mary's Roman Catholic Church at the top of Plandome Road was full every Sunday. And even the people who didn't go considered themselves very good Catholics. But we were an island of secularity in the midst of a Catholic town. Religion didn't really work for my family, for various reasons. Our sanctuary was the saloon, 142 steps from my grandfather's house.
Your uncle Charlie suffered from an ailment. I just met someone who had the same one recently, alopecia.
Right.
Where you lose all the hair on your body.
Right. Uncle Charlie, the chief bartender at this bar, who also lived in my grandfather's house, along with the cousins, aunts, dogs. the defining tragedy in his life was this alopecia, and it left him without a single strand of hair on his entire body, and it stripped his psyche clean. It left him pathologically self-conscious and also angry at the fate that had dealt him this blow. He was a very dashingly handsome young man, and in his early 20s, when he lost all his hair, he felt that he'd lost his looks and he'd lost his future. And then he had some hard breaks after that. And so the bar was where he hid from life and sulked and tried to regroup. And I watched him hide in that bar. And instead of seeing the error of his ways, I thought that was very romantic. I thought it was terribly romantic that he found this place to hide from the world and to pout in a kind of Byronic way, you know. And that was one of the early events that set me up to think of that bar as a place that you could go and hide from tragedy or bad breaks.
Your other refuge, obviously, was books.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the first book that you really fell in love with?
Yes, and I write a little bit about that. It was a book called Minute Biographies. I think the publication date was about 1930. And it was a very simple book. I don't know why I don't know entirely why it caught my imagination, except that it was these very minor, tiny portraits of great men. And from the earliest age that I can remember, I was fixated on men. Not knowing my father and missing my father, wondering about him, set me up to sort of romanticize the masculine. And this book, Minute Biographies, was this compendium of little thumbnail sketches of great men, Caesar, Machiavelli, Voltaire, Longfellow, down through the ages. And the writing was very simple. The drawings were childlike. They were pen and ink drawings of these great men. And I was just enthralled with this book. I carried it with me everywhere. And it, along with The Jungle Book, those were my first two great loves. I read them over and over and always had them in the basket of my bike. And in a very odd way, they also set me up to worship the guys in this bar, because by the time I met the fellas from the bar, I was seeing every guy as Voltaire, Longfellow, Caesar, or Baloo or Bagheera, the characters from Kipling's classic.
Your parents' marriage lasted 7 months longer than that of Truman Capote's, which ended on the wedding night, I believe.
That's an achievement, I guess. They were married yet 2 years, maybe, or together 2 years.
Do you know what the founding grievance was in their marriage?
It was my father's inability to manage this volatile nature of his. you know, along with his great gifts, he had this curse. It was partly a terrible temper, but it was also, it was an inability to deal with any setback. He was so talented, but he felt that his talents weren't recognized, and he felt that he should be the king of New York, and he wasn't willing to wait for that to happen, and he was terribly jealous. I mean, he was just so filled with rage when he wasn't being brilliant and charismatic and magnetic and charming. He was just full of anger and bile, and that eventually turned to violence, physical violence. And he tried to kill my mother one day, and that was the day we left him for good. Her immediate concern was just the two of us, her and I, being safe. But she didn't. She had no intention to cut him out of my life. That was his choosing. Once she left and asked for a divorce, he decided to hell with us. And so he left. He kept himself away. She threw away his pictures. And so by the time I was really conscious in this world, I had no sense of him except this voice, which was omnipresent. I had no idea what he looked like, and I knew all too well what he sounded like. I can't remember who told me that was my father's voice on the radio. But once I learned that was his voice, there was no forgetting it. He had this incredibly rich, plummy, dangerous, edgy baritone. And I spent much of my childhood hunkered over the radio looking for his voice. When he wasn't doing a show, he was on commercials. He was also on television. He was everywhere and nowhere at the same time. He was like smoke, you know. And it was haunting. It was an odd way to grow up knowing your father.
He really didn't even have his own real name.
Right.
Nor do you have the real family.
It's a theme in the book. You know, your name, which is the first step in your identity, in my family is always a misstep. My name is this compendium of aliases and lies. And my father's name, Johnny Michaels, was a stage name that he took. To this day, I'm really not entirely sure what his legal name was. I know the name that he was buried with. But I don't know if that was his name by default or if he ever got around to legally changing his name. You know, as far as I know, he and I have the same name. As far as I know, I'm a junior, and that's the origin of J.R. But it goes much deeper than that. And for a long time, to be called J.R. and have that stand for junior and have that stand for the fact that I was named after a guy I'd never met was a great source of shame. And so I added to the problem. I told people many lies when they would ask what J.R. stood for. It got to the point where I was a young man, I didn't even know anymore. I told so many lies about it. It's a real theme in the book that this business of naming ourselves.
Well, I myself have a made-up name and always considered myself to be German until my aunt told me we were really Czech.
Oh, really? Okay. So. Well, I considered myself to be German because the name Moehringer is German, and then I met my father when I was 17, and he told me that we're not related by blood or marriage to a living or dead Moehringer, that this was a made-up name his father had used to get a job in a factory run by Germans. That, in fact, I was related to Atanasios. And so then I had this name that was a hybrid of my grandfather's dead German. I mean, it was an alias. It was a surname I had no feeling for. And now I learned that I wasn't related to anybody named Moehringer. And then later I learned that Moehringer means eater of many carrots in German, which is really yeah. I write about how I almost changed my name legally when I was 21. I almost changed my name to J.R. Maguire, Maguire being my mother's maiden name, and that led to a whole comedy of errors. And I wasn't able to get the job done, get the forms filed. And now I'm just, you know, I am J.R. Moehringer for better or worse. No one can pronounce the name. I'm constantly asked what J.R. stands for, and I take a deep breath and think, where do I begin? But that's, you know, that's the nature of, I think all names have a story behind them.
Somehow you got into Yale. What was Yale like for you? I mean, was it a good place to go for you? Or?
Well, somehow is the operative word. You know, I mean, I was a kid with good grades from a bad public school. By then, my mother had moved me to Scottsdale, Arizona, because she was always in search of a better life. And things were mostly worse in Scottsdale, but I think probably coming from a place like that instead of New York probably made my application stand out a little bit. The competition wasn't as stiff in that high school that I went to in Arizona. And I was way over my head coming from the desert and no money and having lived on food stamps, and I was really rough around the edges, and I arrived at Yale as a scholarship student, a full scholarship student, and just no idea what I had gotten myself into. It was a terribly difficult time because I felt that I didn't fit in, and the work was way over my head, and my mother had not been allowed to go to college by my grandfather. He'd forbidden her to go to college. So her great hope was that I would get the education she'd been denied. So every time I had a misstep in college, I felt guilty that I wasn't exploiting this opportunity that she would have given her right arm for. Those were tough 4 years. But in the end, I do feel very grateful to have a Yale degree. You know, it has opened some doors for me, I think. It's closed some, though, too. And it made my life problematic in my hometown because people always took a stance that I was going to put on airs with them when I went back to Manhasset, especially in the bar. It was something to be overcome, the fact that I graduated from Yale.
Well, what was the best thing that happened to you at Yale?
Well, the best thing that happened to me was also the worst thing that happened to me, which was that I fell in love with the great love of my life. This woman, I call her Sydney in the book. It's one of only three names that I change in the book. And I learned a lot about love, and I learned a lot about myself, and I learned a lot about heartache, and listened to a lot of Frank Sinatra. Those were, in the beginning, when it was going well, those were some of the most euphoric moments of my life. And then when it went south, and it went sour, and then when it was over, around the time I graduated, those were some of the most painful moments of my life. And so, yeah, it's all wrapped up together, the best and the worst. And when I graduated from Yale with pretty subpar grades and no marketable skills, like so many kids who graduate from college, and a broken heart, the natural thing for me to do was drift back down to Manhasset and burrow into that bar and kind of wait for an idea to dawn, wait to discover what life had in store for me. And it was a place I'd seen not just my uncle, but other men go to nurse a broken heart. And it seemed so natural to me at the time. Now I look back and I wonder what thought process led me to think that Yale to that bar was the right route. But at the time, it felt almost inevitable.
Stepping back a bit, there were two men that you met while working at a bookstore, Bill
right.
and Bud.
Right.
And I think their influence on you was really tremendous.
Profound, yeah. Well, they're the reason I got into Yale, along with my mother. Here I was in this bad public school. Right when I started high school, my mother and I filed bankruptcy. Times were really... she had no education, and the wages were very low, especially for a woman in the 1970s. And so I got this job. At 13 years old, I found a job at this bookstore, which was manned by these two asexual, misanthropic, hermit bookstore clerks, Bill and Bud. And there was a period of adjustment because they were so odd and so different from the men I had known up to that point, all of whom were barflies. But these guys, they were like creatures out of a fairy tale because they just appeared in my life at the right moment, at the beginning of high school. And they were appalled that I was being let down by the public schools. And so what they did was they gave me books, and they sat with me in the back room where they hid from the world, and they would talk with me about books. Now, all the books they were giving me were stolen, which I didn't care at the time. But it was a strange, almost like a Fagin-like den of thieves that we were running in that stockroom where we were stealing books from the bookstore, and they were teaching me as best they could about the world. But they transmitted their love of literature. Their only aspiration in life was to read. And they really turned me on to reading in a way that no one ever has before or since. And we would talk about the great American novels, and we would really explore them. And they had such a reverence for good writing, and they gave that to me. And they really did the best they could to prep me for college. And I know that if I did well in high school and on my SATs, it was because of Bill and Bud. And even my Yale essay... I was temporarily seized by insanity. At the time I was writing my essay, I made these long lists of $15 words that I thought would impress the admissions committee. And these word lists that I concocted resulted in some just jaw-dropping sentences in these essays that my mother saved make the Unabomber's letters look like Emily Dickinson. and she would tell me, we would have these arguments. I would say, this essay will get me accepted. And she would say very quietly, that essay will get you committed. And I was not smart enough to believe her and didn't believe her until Bill and Bud told me that she had been far too kind in her appraisal of my writing. And so I finally wrote an essay for Yale about Bill and Bud and how they had given me books and they had given me a love of literature, and that I saw Yale as an enlargement of this experience, and that was the one that Bill and Bud and my mother approved. And yes, they had this incredibly profound effect on me. And also, you know, they filled in for the men at the bar when I needed it the most, because I fell in love with these guys from the bar when I was about 11 years old, and then my mother moved me to Arizona. So now the men I'd found to replace my father I was missing and longing for, and up popped Bill and Bud. So I've been blessed in my life by this succession of wonderful surrogate fathers. And, you know, it's the sort of the secret to the story is that the worst break I ever caught in my life was my father abandoning me when I was 7 months. And the best break I ever caught was my father abandoning me when I was 7 months, because without that abandonment, I wouldn't have met all these wonderful characters in this book.
Would you read for us about Bill and Bud?
Bill and Bud.
And for those of you who have just joined us, this is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today is J.R. Moehringer, and he's reading from his memoir, The Tender Bar.
Bill and Bud both seemed to fear people, all people, except each other, which was one reason they hid in the stockroom. The other reason was that they read constantly. They had read everything ever written and were hell-bent to read everything new published each month, which required that they cloister themselves like medieval monks. Though in their mid-30s, both men lived with their mothers, had never been married, and seemed to have no aspirations to move on or marry. They had no aspirations beyond reading and no interests outside the store, though their interest in me was growing daily. They questioned me about my mother, my father, Uncle Charlie, and the men, and they were fascinated by my relationship with Dickens. That was the name of the bar. They asked about Steve, the owner, and his motivation in giving the bar such a literary name, which led to a conversation about books generally. Bill and Bud quickly gleaned that I loved books and knew nothing about them. Through a series of rapid, probing questions, they ascertained that I was intimately familiar with only The Jungle Book and Minute Biographies. They were appalled and angry with my teachers. "What are you reading in school right now?" Bill asked. "Scarlet's Letter," I said. He put a hand over his eyes. Bud sniffed his fist. That was Bud's habit whenever he was excited to sniff his fist. "It's The Scarlet Letter," Bud said, "not Scarlet's. It's not the sequel to Gone with the Wind." "Do you like it?" Bill asked. "Kind of boring," I said. "Of course," Bud said. "You have no frame of reference. You're 13. "I actually turned 14 last..." "You know all about lust and nothing about shame," Bud said. "He needs a nice healthy dose of Jack London," Bill said to Bud. "Maybe Twain," Bud said. "Maybe," Bill said, "maybe. But the boy's from the East Coast. He should read New York writers. Dos Passos, Wharton, Dreiser." "Dreiser? You want him to turn into a cynic like you? And no one reads Dos Passos anymore. Dos Passos is Dos Passé. If he wants to read about the East Coast, let him read Cheever." "Who's Cheever?" I asked. They turned slowly toward me. "That settles that," Bud said. "Come with me," Bill said. He took me to the fiction section and pulled down every title by John Cheever, including the thick collection of short stories that had just been published. He brought the books into the stockroom and quickly ripped the cover off each one. It seemed to cause him pain, like ripping off a bandage. I asked what he was doing. He said bookstores couldn't return every unsold paperback to the publishers. Publishers didn't have room for them all. So they returned only the covers. When Bill and Bud wanted a book, they simply ripped off the cover and mailed it to the publisher, who reimbursed the chain and, quote, "everyone is happy." He assured me this wasn't stealing. I couldn't have cared less. On Friday afternoons, Bill and Bud would quiz me about what I'd read that week in school. They would then cluck with disgust and take me around the bookstore filling a shopping bag with coverless books. "Every book is a miracle," Bill said. "Every book represents a moment when someone sat quietly, and that quiet is part of the miracle, make no mistake, and tried to tell the rest of us a story." Bud could talk ceaselessly about the hope of books, the promise of books. He said it was no accident that a book opened just like a door. Also, he said, intuiting one of my many neuroses, I could use books to put order to chaos. At 14, I felt more vulnerable than ever to chaos. My body grew, sprouted hair, shuddered with urges I didn't understand, and the world beyond my body seemed equally volatile and capricious. My days were controlled by teachers. My future was in the hands of heredity and luck. Bill and Bud promised, however, that my brain was my own and always would be. They said that by choosing books, the right books, and reading them slowly, carefully, I could always retain control of at least that one thing. Books were the main part of Bill and Bud's lesson plan, but not the only part. They tackled how I talked, teaching me to modify my Long Island accent. When I said I was going for coffee, they made me stop and say it again. They tried to improve how I dressed. Though hardly fashion plates themselves, they had learned a thing or two from scouring the Italian and French magazines that they ordered for the store, and they often asked salesgirls from boutiques in the mall to advise me about stretching my, quote, trousseau. I had no idea what they meant. They broke me of my habit of wearing nothing but jeans and white T-shirts, and Bud gave me Lacoste shirts he'd, quote, outgrown, though I suspected the shirts were gifts from his mother and actually too big for him. They supplied me with basic information about art, architecture, and especially music. Sinatra was fine, Bud said, but there were other immortals. Sniffing his fist, he made a list of records every cultured young man must own. Dvorak, Schubert, Debussy, Mozart, especially Mozart. Bud was devoted to Mozart. I folded his list and put it in my pocket and saved it for years because it was such a touching and earnest recipe for betterment. I told Bud, however, that I couldn't afford records. The next day he brought in all the records on the list from his own collection. Call it a loan, he said. We sat in the stockroom, Bud playing the records on a portable turntable, conducting with a pencil, explaining why Mozart's piano sonata in C major was perfection, why Beethoven's trios were sublime. While Bud tutored me in music, Bill made the greater sacrifice. He manned the cash register all afternoon. For me, he said, and only me, he would deal with the madding crowd.
Thanks for reading that, J.R.
Thank you.
What were the most important books that they turned you on to?
Well, they found out that I came from the place that had given birth to The Great Gatsby and had never read it, so they were the first people to make me read The Great Gatsby. And Cheever, to whom they introduced me, has been a lifelong passion of mine. John Cheever is a great literary hero of mine. I think he is the greatest short story writer in American history, to put it simply. Hemingway, they explained to me. I was predisposed to love Hemingway because I was romanticizing the masculine. But they showed me the nuance of the short stories. They made me look beyond the image, the macho image of Hemingway. And after I demonstrated that I was able to appreciate the genius of The Great Gatsby, they took me through all of Fitzgerald. They did turn me on to Dos Passos. I think those are the names that spring to mind when I think of Bill and Bud. The Holy Trinity for them was Hemingway, Fitzgerald, and Cheever. And they must have really had an infectious spirit because those are the three faces on my literary Mount Rushmore.
Although you tried to write a novel for a while, I think you really chose journalism because you knew yourself better, that you would do better as a journalist. What was there in your self-knowledge that pointed you in that direction, though?
Well, I still haven't sorted that out. I mean, I feel more like I stumbled into journalism because the only thing I did well in college was write for the school newspaper. That was the only thing that seemed to come to me with any ease. And I felt that was directly attributable to being from Manhasset and from a town full of storytellers and a family full of storytellers. This was something I could do every day and feel some sense of mastery, some sense of competence. And when I graduated with the bad grades and no self-confidence, I at least had some clips from the Yale Daily News and used them to get myself a job as a copy boy at the New York Times. And once I walked into the newsroom at the New York Times, I felt that was where I wanted to be, in newsrooms. Again, I heard the sound of the typewriters clacking, the vast sea of typewriters. And an old-timer told me once to listen to that sound. He said, that story's getting told. I thought that was a great description of what happens in a newsroom. And so for me, journalism was the only way to tell stories and get paid for it and have health insurance and some sense of security. I grew up not just the men from the bar who were surrogate fathers to me. They worshiped newspaper men, and I think if Bill and Bud gave me a love of Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Cheever, the guys from the bar turned me on to Liebling and Jimmy Cannon and Grantland Rice, and so many and Breslin, so many great newspaper writers. So I knew a lot about the newspaper game, even though I didn't know anything about being a newspaper man. And it just seemed like the only thing that I was fit to do or might be fit to do in this world. But for me, the real writing, you know, true writing was always the novel. And so even while I was trying to learn journalism, I was always dreaming of being a novelist. And so from a very early age, probably around the time I met Bill and Bud, I was trying to turn my experiences, my childhood experiences, but particularly my experiences with the guys from the bar into a novel. And I spent more than 20 years trying to write that novel, which has now resulted in this memoir. I mean, I tell people that this memoir is a failed novel, and I'm not being flippant. It really is the result of so many abortive attempts at writing a novel.
Well, are you working on a novel now?
No, I'm just working on recovering from writing this book, and I'm learning how to explain this book, you know, which is a separate skill. When you tour with a book, it's very interesting. You go to different places, and people are interested to know about your book, but they want what's the pitch? What's the story? And you learn about the story by boiling it down, by abbreviating it, by explaining it to different crowds and discovering what it is, what avenue into the story they find. Are they interested in the mother-son relationship? Are they interested in surrogate fathers? Are they interested in finding a community in a place like a bar or a school? What I'm concentrating on right now is explaining my book, rediscovering it in a different way. I hope one day to write a novel, but it's all I can do right now to just go around and talk to people about this book. I can't imagine writers who write while they're on tour. I envy them and admire them so.
You credit John Stauffer at Harvard. You were there on a fellowship with turning you on to some really good memoirs.
Yes.
You remember what some of those were that stood out?
Yes. When I finally decided that this novel was not going to work and that I should try and write this book that I had wanted to write my whole life as nonfiction, I was lucky enough to meet John Stauffer, a brilliant professor at Harvard and an expert on American memoir. He tutored me privately and introduced me to, Mary Anton's The Promised Land, Lauren Isley's All the Strange Hours. These are, you know, when you meet people who know these books, they love them to distraction, but they're not the first books people think of when they hear the word memoir. They've come and gone. They've had their day, which is a shame because they're great books. Frederick Exley's A Fan's Notes, which is a fictional memoir, but brilliant. One of the great books, one of the great American novels / memoirs of the second half of the 20th century.
A great dipsomaniac book, too.
Great drinker's book, but just hauntingly beautiful writing. He turned me on to the slave narratives, which were such a part of, you know, American literature. Frederick Douglass being the most famous of them, but there were others that we read, and also the captivity memoirs. There was this great strain in American literature. It was very popular reading, and now we have no memory of it, but as America pushed west, there would be settlers who would be kidnapped by Native Americans or vice versa. And so they would be raised in different cultures. And then they would either live to a ripe old age or among their captors, or they would escape. Either way, they would write memoirs of their experiences. And Americans were fascinated by these clash of culture stories and these memoirs of, you know, talk about an identity crisis, you know. And we read some of those but we spent a lot of time on the first great American memoir, which is, of course, the first great American bestseller, Ben Franklin's autobiography, which set the tone for all memoirs. I mean, really, you can make a parallel between almost every memoir we read and Franklin's hallmark work, and even Fitzgerald was haunted by Franklin. I mean, there's a direct allusion to Ben Franklin in The Great Gatsby, which had memoirish qualities to it. John Stauffer, to his everlasting credit, made a long syllabus and assigned me 3 or 4 books a week. And I was with him for most of the year. So the list goes on and on. Maybe someday on the website for the Tender Bar, I'll post the syllabus that he created for me, because he deserves more credit for his selflessness as a teacher. I mean, he really did this for nothing more than the occasional cup of coffee I brought him, and also the enthusiasm he saw in me. You know, I hadn't had many happy experiences with professors at Yale, being a kid overmatched intellectually, academically. And he saw how responsive I was to a professor who never made me feel stupid, who always thought that my ideas were valid, legitimate, corrected me in a very gentle way. Those were some really nice moments in his office with the New England winter coming on and talking about the three or four memoirs he'd assigned me that week.
Did you ever read Fitzgerald's The Crack-Up?
Oh, I did. Not for him. We read Movable Feast, which I think is a better memoir, but I think it was published posthumously, Hemingway's memoir of Paris. A better memoir.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great, truly, truly underrated, some of Hemingway's best writing in Movable Feast. We read that one. We read Sherwood Anderson's memoir, Totally Forgotten, A Storyteller's Story. I think that's the title. Theodore Dreiser wrote a very interesting memoir called, he wrote several memoirs. One was called Dawn, and there's quite a lot in there about his mother. We read Russell Baker. We, of course, read Tobias Wolff, which, you know, every time I read it, I'm struck, dumbstruck by how brilliant it is.
And what about Geoffrey Wolff's Duke of Deception?
I read that on my own. I read that, and the Duke, his name for his father, had a lot of qualities, the con man element of the Wolff's father. Very reminiscent of my father, who was also a con man. And, of course, we read Stop Time, Frank Conroy's book. I had never read that. Somehow I'd gotten through life without having read that.
One of the great American memoirs.
One of the very greatest American memoirs. And it really, talk about a book that stands the test of time. So, yeah, I mean, some of these books I knew about, like Stop Time, and had not read. Others I would have never known about but for John Stauffer. And for that matter, he turned me on to Franklin Evans, which the story of an inebriate, which is Walt Whitman's only novel.
Really? I've never heard of it.
All hail John Stauffer. He informed me of this book. He said that Whitman had written a temperance novel. And he said that since I was so enthralled by Whitman, and so, I love the 19th century American writers, Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman. He said if that was the case, I should know about Whitman's novel about drinking to excess. Well, I couldn't believe there was such a thing out there and that I hadn't known about it. And he somehow purloined a copy for me, and I read it. And just, you know, it's not a very good book. And talk about dated. I mean, those temperance novels are they're strange, and it's an odd moment in American literature. But it was so great to know that there was a tradition and that Whitman wrote about drink. And that's overall what Stauffer did for me, is he made me feel that even though my childhood was unusual, how many kids grow up in a bar, but there were elements of it that fit hand in glove with this tradition of American memoir, that all memoirs at their heart, all American memoirs, are about escape. And invariably the root out of the hole that the writer finds him or herself in is education, no matter how you want to define education, whether it's the attainment of a college degree, or it's the school of hard knocks, or it's refining your identity or discovering what your place geographically or psychically is in the world. It's about education. That's the way that American writers find their escape from unhappy childhoods or unhappy adulthoods. And to discover that this theme in my life was a strain in the American in American literature was ennobling. It made me feel like I was working in a field that had been plowed, and harvested by some of my heroes. And that just made me feel less alone in those days when you feel so alone as a writer, you know, in the middle of a book.
Would you give us a reading now? And it's about the Vietnam veteran, Cager.
Okay, sure. One of my favorite guys in the bar.
And for those of you who have just joined us, this is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today, J.R. Moringer, reading from his memoir, The Tender Bar.
This is a passage about a Vietnam vet at the bar, Cager, who was one of my favorites and saved me many times and literally saved my life one night. But this is the night that I met him. It was the night I turned, the week I turned 18 years old, which at the time was the legal drinking age in New York, and I went to the bar for the first time to have my first legal drink with the guys. It was the night they called my bar mitzvah when I became a man. And it was a great debate that night about what I was going to drink and what kind of drinker I would be. The kind of debate you'd see on C-SPAN if they were all drunk during those parliamentary debates they show on C-SPAN. And at some point in the debate, I met Cager, and he told me about his experience in Vietnam, and it was love at first sight with Cager. So, if Cager felt any lingering bitterness about what he'd endured, he didn't show it, though he did confess to a recurring nightmare. Sitting in Publicans, the bar name had changed by this time from Dickens to Publicans. Drinking a cold Budweiser, he looks up and sees some officers coming through the door. "Time to report, soldier." "You got the wrong guy," he tells them. "I did my time. 1 year, 7 months, 5 days." They don't believe him. "On your feet, grunt. Time to hump that M60 across the Mekong. Time to leave this bar." "Did you ever think about Canada?" I asked. He frowned. His father was regular Army, a veteran of World War II, and Cager worshipped the old man. They went to Army-Navy football games together when Cager was a boy, and his father took him into the Army locker room. His father introduced him to Eisenhower and MacArthur. "You don't forget a thing like that," Cager said. So when his father died at the start of Vietnam, he added, "What else could a devoted son do but go to war?" I asked Uncle Charlie if I could buy Cager a beer. "Cager," he said, "you're backed up on the birthday boy." Uncle Charlie slammed the bar and pointed at my chest, the first time he'd ever given me this signal of official approval, which felt like having Excalibur tapped on each shoulder. He pulled $3 from my pile and winked at me. I understood that my drinks were free while drinks I bought for others were not. I was glad. I wanted to pay for Cager's drink. I realized that the same rule must apply when a man offered to buy me a drink. Uncle Charlie would charge the man $1 as a token. Money wasn't the issue. It was the gesture, the timeless gesture, buying another man a drink. The whole barroom was an intricate system of such gestures and rituals and habits. Cager explained it all to me. He told me, for instance, that Uncle Charlie always worked the west end of the bar, under the stained glass penis, because Uncle Charlie didn't like to deal with waitresses putting in drink orders from the dining room at the east end. Joey D. liked the waitresses, however, and therefore Joey D. always worked the east end under the stained glass vagina. Somehow, Cager said, the conversation at each end of the bar reflected the stained glass backdrop, bawdier and more aggressive at Uncle Charlie's end, mellower and less linear at Joey D.'s. I also noticed that everyone in the place had his or her own unique way of asking for a drink. "Joey D., can you build on this concept? Goose, would you freshen up my martini once more before I go home to my miserable excuse for a husband?" One man would ask for a refill by merely flicking his eyes at his empty glass, as if checking the speedometer while driving down a highway. Another would extend his hand and touch pointer fingers with Uncle Charlie, reenacting Michelangelo's creation of Adam. There couldn't be too many bars in the world, I thought, where a man acted out a scene from the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel when he wanted an Amstel Light. I bummed one of Cager's Merit Ultras and never wanted to leave his side. I wonder if he came to Publicans every night. I'd wish he'd been a part of the Gilgo Beach crew when I was a boy, but I couldn't imagine a man like Cager lounging on the sand or body surfing. I couldn't imagine a man like Cager anywhere but this bar late at night. He seemed too big, too mythic, to simply be walking down the street in broad daylight. I realized that for the first time in months I felt no fear, as if Cager's courage were rubbing off. Cager was contagious. He had been through the fires of hell and come back with his mind and sense of humor intact, and just standing by his side made me confident about my own small battles. The euphoria I felt was the same I'd experienced reading the Iliad. In fact, the bar and the poem complemented each other like companion pieces. Each smacked of ageless verities about men. Cager was my Hector. Uncle Charlie was my Ajax. Smelly the cook was my Achilles. Lines from Homer came back to me, and I heard them in new ways. "There is a strength," Homer wrote, "in the union even of very sorry men." How could you hope to fully appreciate such a line unless you'd bought Cager a Budweiser and listened to his war story? The best part was, when Cager stopped talking, I wouldn't have to prove to some satanic professor that I'd absorbed every word and learned what I was supposed to learn. And yet I was very much a student that night, jotting notes of what Cager and others said, their stories and snappy remarks. I took more notes than in Professor Lucifer's class because I didn't want to forget. Curiously, the men didn't think twice about my note-taking. They acted as though they had been wondering when someone was going to start recording their hard-won wisdom.
Thanks for reading that, J.R.
Thank you.
For Between the Covers, this is Jim Schumach, my guest today, memoirist J.R. Moehringer. He is the author of the memoir, The Tender Bar. just published by Hyperion.
Thank you for having me.
All of a sudden, I could hear somebody whistling from right behind me. I turned around and she said,